Hello, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of The Naturalist Capitalist. I hope you're all having a great weekend. I've got a return guest on the show this evening. Although if you're just a YouTube subscriber, you might not have seen him because he was on the 8th Four Horsemen and that got taken down. But it is still up on Odyssey, and I think I have a 10-minute clip of it on YouTube that'll link you there. That was an interesting discussion, but wanted to have him on alone so I could just talk with him because that was kind of a crowded conversation. It's DJ Thermal Detonator, or Nelson is his name, but that's what he goes by.
Nelson Martins, but
yeah. So how you doing tonight, man?
Good. Thanks for having me on. Glad to be here.
Yeah, for sure. So why don't you tell us how you got into all of this? What, I don't know if you were interested in politics or anything before this happened, but what put you down this specific avenue of research?
It starts with 9/11, obviously, and that's even being political as an activist. I have my own story as far as the day of 9/11 and like what I noticed, I think I started to have problems about a year later after I was already working at Amoeba Music in Hollywood, and it had opened actually a month after 9/11. So it was kind of like, even my job interview was 2 days after 9/11 and I scored the job, but, I started having problems. Like, I even had my landlord like a year later was telling me, they're trying to go into Iraq, they've got all this oil and they've had all this stuff reserved. And it's just like, I thought that just kind of weird. I'm like, I thought that we're supposed to be going after bin Laden, and 2004, kind of rolls around, and I already seen some of the anti-war, marches going on. I was never going to get ever involved with any of it, but I thought it was interesting, but I didn't know. I didn't have an opinion to, as far as what this all meant. But, by 2004, when I saw Fahrenheit 9/11 from Michael Moore, it got me so angry. Just because of it really opened up the door for conspiracy theories for me as far as modern day, ones. I kind of knew about JFK. I saw the movie back in the day in the 90s when it came out. I would think it was like 19 or 20 years old. I used to watch stuff like X-Files, stuff on Fox TV back in the 90s as well. But, when it came, with Fahrenheit 9/11, I just thought that there was like a possible Bush and bin Laden conspiracy going on. I thought all the laws that are put in place, the Patriot Act, just everything in there just got me really mad. And then, by the time 2007 rolled around and I wasn't working at Amoeba anymore, then I ran into, Loose Change, and I was already hearing about Terror Storm from Alex Jones because it was a DVD we had at my job at Amoeba Music. We had a big video section with a really, really hefty documentary section. So I used to check out a lot of the DVDs there for a long time. This is before I was really getting really good with, using the internet and really using the search engine as far as, this is still when Google Video is still around, So 2004. So, so it's about 2007, I'm pissed off about it. I see Loose Change, I see Zeitgeist. Then, a friend of mine ended up telling me about Ron Paul and, because he was anti-war and all that. I didn't even know what position he had on 9/11, but I thought, if he wants to turn things around as far as that goes, definitely, want to get into this guy. And, lo and behold, I started, getting into, libertarianism, learning a lot more about it, from Ron Paul, and, going to all the debates, rallies that they had at the, when he come and speak and do the debates in Southern California. I attended quite a few of those, started meeting people. Then I started really figuring out who Alex Jones and InfoWars was, because I knew about the Terror Storm DVD. And then I started to see once Ron Paul stopped running, I started listening to InfoWars, started noticing that Ron Paul was a regular there. And I'm like, oh my God, I found the right spot. And, here it is, 9/11 truth. And, we are change and all that. And then about 2008 is when I found out that there was a We Are Change LA chapter, and I got really involved with it. And it was already going on for about a year, and it eventually ended up being taken over by my friend Ed Brotherton, who's still somewhat active, at least online, with 9/11 research and other things, as far as even the gold and all that. Constitution, militia, all that kind of stuff. But that's where I started. And then, I only listened to Alex Jones for like 4 years. By 2012, I stopped before the whole Sandy Hook thing even happened. It was actually a consequence because of the 2012 election. I wasn't very happy with the way things went on with that, as far as, Peter Thiel, the Bilderberg stuff that I'd heard, I ended up being right. That's when there was flags raised. I was just really, really suspicious, and I just really completely stopped. And by that point, I was already starting to make films, and I was using a lot of Ryan Dawson's work, most of a lot of the stuff from War Die Deception. And then eventually just started doing my own and expanding and doing more of my own narrations, and have my channel now, and I'm up to 8 or 9 films now, besides a multiple short films. And that's pretty much how I got here.
Yeah. So just for anyone who doesn't know, I think it would be interesting to talk about your kind of falling out with InfoWars, or, when you started realizing that all that was, just kind of sensationalism. When did you start seeing that? And then what do you think about all that today?
It's gotten way worse. I never imagined things would come out to the way that we are now. I never thought we would have someone like Trump and, him appear on Alex Jones and all that. To me, it was very, really simple. I stuck with 9/11, very, I don't want to say faithfully, but, very much you created this movement, you're stuck with it. We need to accomplish something. We need to stick with that. And I could tell Jones wasn't really behind it all the way. It's like he put his Zionist skeleton in the closet soon after 9/11 happened, because he obviously was one then. And then things started to change by the time the second term of Obama, came around, and he really got on to the birthers, and then after that, that already beginning the false flag shooting stuff with Batman, and then, Sandy Hook happens. But for me, the first thing that I started noticing, being highly suspicious of Jones, was about 2 years into it, when 2010, when he did the gun rally thing in Austin, where he just showed up with the megaphone, and he was invited to speak at the podium, but he was just yelling, just starting, getting on people's nerves, just all over the street, it was just like, dude, these people are here. They're organizing something. They're allowing you. They want you to speak. Just go up there, And I've been around rallies. I've been around, lots of things, a lot of functions like that. You just don't act like that. You just don't do that. Right. So it's just like, dude, this guy's not on our side. No, So, and then it just got worse. Like I said, I can't believe it. But at the same time, I feel I've been redeemed, because it's like, I was one of these people telling them way early, hey, your guys are going down a, going down the wrong road with the Sandy Hook thing. Not the people in InfoWars directly, but the people who were still buying into that. And lo and behold, I was right. All these channels are yanked now, you know? And yeah. It's just gotten worse and worse now with big tech.
Yeah, what I think is weird is it doesn't really seem to be a sliding scale. It seems to kind of be complete craziness. And then like you, Adam Fitzgerald, Ryan Dawson, you know, you guys are all kind of on the same page. And then everyone else is like, it's like crazy stuff. And it's just, there doesn't seem to be much in between. Is that accurate or am I seeing that wrong?
As far as in between on what?
Just between, like, I mean, it seems like if you buy into the 9/11 conspiracies, most people just kind of go full bore with it. You know, it's like fake planes, there were no hijackers. Like, they just kind of tend to buy all of that. It doesn't really seem to be like, some people are like, well, I don't know, this seems kind of weird. But, you know, it seems to be like a really big divide, I guess.
It's turned into a divide, but the problem was that all the people who, you know, established themselves in the truth movement, they all started with this whole thing with no plane hitting the Pentagon, questioning if there was hijackers or not. And that's still stuck on the old films, and people classically always go back to that. They always think about when I saw Loose Change or when I saw Zeitgeist. And I even tried challenging Peter Joseph about it on Twitter, and he just said, he just kind of like, oh, nobody cares about 9/11 anymore. So what, you know, he made some comment about, you know, making fun of Alex Jones and distancing himself from crazy conspiracy theories. And I'm like, well, dude, you still have those crazy conspiracy theories in Zeitgeist. You still say no plane hit the Pentagon. You still say all this crap, you know? And, you know, that's like I said, they established themselves. And unfortunately, it's got that stigma still. You know, people still think truther means, you know, this whole no planer standard. And that's what we're trying to wipe away. That's what we're trying to either divide, you know, separate. Yeah, I'm very divisive over that issue. And I think it ultimately does matter, you know, as far as like, what, no matter what people have their problems with what happened to the World Trade Center, that's just one part of the cover up. It gets deeper when we, you know, when we go into the hijackers. I think you already know that yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what's weird is it's basically a religion, right? Like, you've established truth and then you hold that truth regardless of what information you come across. Which I think is interesting because, you know, you, Ryan, and Adam, you guys are all atheists like me, and that does seem to change the way people process information a little bit. You know, like, I've always thought, to be an honest observer, you should be agnostic as to what the truth is. You shouldn't try to be saying like, well, I really want this thing to end up being true, and I'm going to go through all these situations and just only look at what lines up with that. Like, if you really want to figure out what's going on, you should have no idea about what is real and then base reality off of what you can actually sift through, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for myself, you know, yeah, I mean, I've told people before, I'm like an atheist from Monday to Tuesday, and from Wednesday to Thursday, I'm an agnostic. And then from Friday to Sunday, I'm a deist. there definitely seems to be something there as far as the people who are more religious, you know, religious right. You know, the problem is that Alex Jones had shaped this whole thing, like, basically, you know, seeking 9/11 justice was basically battling the forces of Satan.
Right.
That's basically what that's why he has this whole globalist shtick, you know, with Endgame. It's just complete nonsense. Just I'm not for vaccines and stuff, but I mean, some of them you need, but I have a different opinion as far as what's going on now. But
yeah,
you know, this whole thing of this, I just don't buy it. This whole one, it's, you know, this whole one world system, one, you know, no, there's too many, there's too, yeah. Too many egos out there. Sorry.
Yeah. No, I hear you. Well, let's get into some of your specific content. I just watched two of your videos over the last couple of weeks. I watched the explosions on the George Washington Bridge video, and then the inside job Boston Logan Airport one. So let's actually start with the Boston Logan Airport stuff. That was, I think, one of the first trailers I ever saw was about that video or some video where you were talking about Muhammad Atta and like all these weird rendezvous taking place deep in Maine that don't really make any sense if they're just going to fly, if they're going to end up going back to Boston. And then, none of it really made sense. And then you start seeing that there are all these meetings that were probably taking place from people coming across the border of Canada that start making it all make sense. And then the security camera footage, they're very selective in what they use because they only want you to see the hijackers that supposedly exist. But why don't you just kind of give us the lowdown on what was going on in Maine? How many hijackers do you think there were versus how many we're supposed to think there are? And why are there more hijackers than what we're led to believe?
Well, regarding Muhammad Atta, it seems to me, or from reports, that he had actually went to Maine even a week or week and a half before the weekend before 9/11. And they went all the way up, like up into Bangor, Maine, up into the north part, really close, even much closer to the border.
Right.
And it seems they rendezvoused with people who had come in from Nova Scotia, from the other border entryway, and then one like would be mostly people coming in from Quebec. You know, we don't know how many people came over then and how many people stayed there, but it could have been three or more. But when they went back up the night before 9/11, they didn't go all the way up to Bangor this time. They actually just went up into Portland. But and they went by themselves. It was Muhammad Atta and Abdelaziz Al-Amari. I don't think there was anybody else driving when they went there, but there are some cherry-picked security video with them going to a gas station before reaching Portland, besides more cherry-picked videos. Like, you don't have a full video. It's very select images of them shopping at Walmart. Like, they don't have another security video from a bank teller they went to, because they went to two bank tellers. There's a drive-up one they went to there, and there's no video of it released. So what could have happened there is the weekend before, they may have met with more people who had crossed over, but it seemed like there were at least two accounted for ferry boats coming from Nova Scotia once the week before, and then the following week again. And this one, they have ferry boats that also go straight all the way into Portland from Nova Scotia, as well as the ones that go straight into Bar Harbor, which is near Bangor. So, I don't know who was staying with them, but it seems like there were more people staying with them at the hotel in Portland before they take off to Jetport, Maine. And maybe those other suspects took off before an earlier flight, or could have boarded with them, because there's an incomplete list of names on the passenger manifest for that charter flight. So, you know, it's really, really, really suspicious as far as, you know, why they would cover up all these additional suspects, all these other people. But then, as you come to find out, which I point out in my film, well, there were more planes at Boston Logan that were supposed to be hijacked. And that opens up a whole door as far as the other airports as well. But just as a focus on Boston, Massachusetts, yeah, there may have been at least five, maybe even more planes that they were intended to target. And these people that they, you know, these people that came crossed over from Canada, and there's others that came across, you know, late minute, even from Florida, possibly as well as, this is all part of the cover up. And what I try to explain is a much bigger operation than what we're led to believe.
So the reason for going to Portland in the official narrative is that it was less scrutinous as far as security goes, right? For the hijackers we got through. That's the whole story, but it's not true.
That's what some people's opinions, but there's no official conclusion why they, you know, reasoning for why they went to avoid more, you know, security. Like what, you know, what for? I mean, they made themselves go through more security going twice, you know, doing that. And then you're also pushing it, you know, you got to make that flight on time. You never know what's going to go on. So that's why I say, you know, look, there's a lot of backup planes that could have happened. They didn't happen because of the, you know, the FAA, you know, grounded all flights. But in some of these circumstances of additional planes at Logan, some of them didn't get hijacked because the rest of the team didn't board the flight. Either they chickened out, had some technical reason why they weren't able to get on the plane.
Yeah. So there was a part in your video about Muhammad Atta where his father is saying that he got called 24 to 48 hours after September 11th attacks. So what is your personal opinion on Muhammad Atta? Do you think he did pilot the plane, or do you think he was on the plane, or do you think it's a Ziad Jarrah situation where he might have ditched last minute? And then there was also, I correct me if I'm wrong, but I felt like it was alluding to the fact that he could have been an Israeli agent too. But just what are your thoughts? What do you think is possible there? And I think it's important to tell everyone, like, I'm speaking for myself here, I am not an expert in this area, especially on this new stuff I've just uncovered. So I just want to hear your opinion. And I know that you're also operating out of a lot of speculation on some of this stuff too. So please, nobody take anything that I am saying here as fact. I find it interesting, and I want Nelson to present the information and, you know, tell us what he thinks could have happened. But that's kind of how I'm viewing all this stuff. So
now, Muhammad Atta, as far as what his father said, yeah, that's possible that he was alive afterwards. But if that is what happened, then that would mean that there had been two Attas operating on, you know, on 9/11, coming in for entering a different way. And the reason why there's a evidence for us is because there's multiple times in the timeline of Muhammad Atta where they say he's somewhere else, and then there's reports of him literally being somewhere else, like even out of the country or just way too far away, states away, you know. And that's possible. Like Atta may have been the second Atta. Like, I think the real Atta is the one we see in Portland, Maine. I think that's the real one, you know. Mm-hmm. It could have slipped off into another plane when he made it to Logan instead of boarding flight 11. But if there was a second Atta, he might have been in Maryland the day before, which there's also problems with Marwan al-Shehhi, the flight 175 hijacker that I point out, because he's witnessed at Dulles Airport on September 10th, the day before, having unrestricted access of Dulles Airport in a United Air Workers ground uniform. He's witnessed it by an employee at Dulles Airport. So, you know, and Marwan al-Shehhi is Muhammad Atta's closest associate and all that. So there might have been a second one there, and then he rendezvoused however way they got to Portland on 9/11 to board the flight. Now, how Muhammad Atta, or whichever Muhammad Atta, whoever hijacked and piloted flight 11, how they boarded the plane, this I do feel confident, and it's speculation, but there's good reason to believe that this happened. But he boarded flight 11 posing as a pilot, taking a jump seat ride, what they also call dead setting. Is I guess there's a pilot share, or you know if a pilot needs to be somewhere else at another airport to fly another flight, they either are able to get this as dead revenue. So they're able to actually fly in the pilot seat, because some of these cockpits usually have one or two extra pilot seats in the back. And Muhammad Atta, there were three other occasions, two other occasions where he was seen you know, taking a flight as a in a pilot seat, and even at one time at Jetport, Maine, 3 or 4 months before 9/11. And the reason why there's also to believe that this also occurred with Boston Logan is because an American Airlines pilot who had flown into Boston from LA, she had seen someone who looked like Atta, dressed up, halfway dressed up, basically in a pilot uniform with a cheap pilot bag. And he ran up to her and said, "Is this your flight?" Like, basically. And she said he was really rude and says, "No," but the way that he approached her, he says it seemed like he was looking to ride on a jump seat. So, and the other problem with that is that both flights, when they take off from Boston Logan, they don't take off. They're not taking off the correct route. They're supposed to take off and go up north, going over into New Hampshire and through the bottom portion of Vermont,
right,
over into the state of New York, over Buffalo and Albany. I'm sorry, I forget Buffalo and I forget which Syracuse.
Yep.
These planes don't do that. They went. They made a complete quick U-turn within the state of Massachusetts and fly all the way across the state of Massachusetts, except for 175, and that cuts it a little bit short. But then they, you know, zigzag, and then they hit the towers. So they never these pilots. So it leads me to think, just like the newscaster I sampled in there, you know, that they took over they had control of the cockpits already in the beginning. I don't know how Flight 175 occurred. We have very little information as far as phone calls and other things goes. But with Flight 11, with Atta, there's all these indicators and there's all these previous cases of Atta, you know, taking a jump seat, you know. And, you know, I would think that's what happened. But I also think that this would probably be the second Atta. Perhaps the one that could speak Hebrew and you know, all the other things, you know, dating the pink-haired stripper and all that really got away, and fled. And, you know, I'm not sure if he was a Mossad agent, but I would think he's possibly an asset, you know, maybe a Mossad asset. But there is something else I will also say, and I didn't put this in the film. I'm going to make a little short film about it. There is actually, regardless of the pink-haired stripper and all that, there is information or evidence out there that suggests that Muhammad Atta was actually gay,
mm-hmm.
and especially even with Marwan al-Shehhi, there are accounts from people that knew them seen them interact and different. And that there's testimony that said that these guys are gay or bi, whatever. But, you know, I don't know the whole situation with Marwan al-Shehhi, but Atta, it seems like it could be possible that, you know, because he's a big partier. He wasn't a fundamentalist. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So, when you talk about the two Attas, the second guy, the one who actually would have flown the plane, who is this guy? Just some.
If it is someone else to just play that character to, because he's part of the Hamburg cell, and the Hamburg cell is definitely the main the brains of the operation, supposedly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you're going to set something up to make it appear that it's really only exclusive to the Al-Qaeda network, that this is just an Osama bin Laden conspiracy, you know, there they have their confession videos, even with Ziad Jarrah, but they say, look, he's acting, but they go to those camps that get, so that's what I figured. That's what I think it is to put, you know, it's basically to bait their presence, you know. Just set up, I've probably not using the right words, just kind of a dummy, you know, to make just to frame, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So Muhammad Atta, he was from Egypt, right? I think.
Yeah.
And he joined Al-Qaeda because of the Israeli occupation of Jordan. Isn't that right? Isn't that the official story? Or
that's something I've heard. There's mm-hmm. there's multiple things. There's too much conflicting information when it comes to Atta. There is really like there's literally almost three historical lines of him, you know, from being in college and like where he was at, and you know, because he went into Syria for a while, and you know, there are points that he may have actually been in Egypt, and apparently he wasn't at that time, vice versa. So, you know, I don't know exactly what his whole beef was. You know, it's kind of been portrayed in other things, but his father was pretty hostile about certain things. You know, he made it, you know, he was pretty clear. You know, he wanted to, you know, he wanted to do another interview if only the money went to a Palestinian charity. So,
yeah. And he was straight up saying that he thought Israel had done the attack. Like, and he was saying they'd done stuff like this before. So, yeah. I don't know. So what about the Delta flight from Boston? That one was like maybe an attempted hijacking that failed. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
To me, that situation, this is Delta 1989, and it's portrayed in the film Loose Change. And they tried to say it was mixed up with Flight 93, that it actually landed in Cleveland, Ohio, that Flight 93 did with you know, with all passengers from all four planes all consolidated into one flight, but that also Delta 1989 landed there. Well, they kind of just destroy, you know, all the story behind Delta 1989 because it landed at a specific time. They screw up with that. But the point that, and they do mention that there was a bomb threat when it had landed, because that's why it landed. But the real issue with it is that there were passengers on that flight that said that there were suspicious Middle Eastern men, you know, throughout the whole course of the flight, even, you know, when they had boarded, were just completely nervous the entire time, looking around, expecting, like they were expecting somebody, and they didn't show up. And there was two of them. So it's possible there may have been one other, you know, operative that was supposed to, you know, one or two, however more, because we got to remember when we talk about Flight 93 and Ziad Jarrah likely not being on there, then we're talking about, well, there's a team of three. So there could have been other teams of three, and there are other cases of it. So with Delta 1989, perhaps maybe the one that had the pilot skills didn't board, so they weren't going to hijack and do nothing, you know. But you know why that person didn't board, we don't know. I don't have a flight manifest. You can't get any of this information. They got it all top secret. So you know, I'm still trying to get information from other flights at other airports, like Flight 23, which was one that was supposedly going to be hijacked by three guys. So,
I mean, this seems like everything was really rough. Like, I mean, it wasn't a smooth operation. There was a lot of, obviously, especially if there were supposed to be 10 planes, like you think there were, and they only end up with 4.5 if they tried the Delta one and it failed. Something that you point to in the video is the fact that a lot of these guys might have not known they actually were carrying out a suicide mission. So how do you convince people to do this in the last minute, get them to kill themselves? Or do you just have the guy who's flying the plane know what's going to happen, or you put him on drugs? How do you pull something like that off?
You pretty much nailed it. I mean, it would be the pilot would probably know what's going on, but they're just going to do a classic hijacking. Well, they may have said like, we'll kill a passenger just to freak everyone else out, but then we're going to land somewhere and pose our demands. But you know, at the same time, at the height of it all, once you've gotten that far, you know, what's going to stop you next? You know, especially if you can't do anything about it, you're on board, you know, you're inside the plane, and you know, you're a hijacker, and you've gotten that far, and they're like, oh, well, we're not going to land, we're actually going to crash somewhere. well, you know, it's like, I mean, the thing is that, you know, every single kind of hijacking, even if it was one of those classic hijackings, it's still considered a suicide mission. You're risking your life to do this. You know, you could still die, you know? So, you know, it's all about being a martyr in the first place, whether you fuck up or not. You're still going to go down in history in their whole world. So it's, you know, that's what I would think that could possibly be. I think some people could have been on drugs. Yeah. But yeah, it's possible some teams completely knew what they were going to do and other ones didn't know. And I think that's possibly a case with Flight 11 or Flight 175, at least.
Mm-hmm. So what about the Flight 77 hijackers? Do you think, what is it, Madar, and what's the other guy's name? I forget.
Nawaf al-Hazmi.
Al-Hazmi, yeah. So do you think they were both legit? They were actually on that plane, or do you think there's...
Oh, no, those people were all on that plane. I made a separate film 4 years now, 6 on 77, the Dulles Airport 9/11 cover-up. And why it's called 6 on 77 is because there were 6 hijackers on Flight 77, not 5.
Right.
And the reason why I say this is there's 2 pieces of evidence. One of them being one of the phone calls from Renee May, the stewardess. She called her parents in Las Vegas. She says they were being taken over by 6 guys. And then when the day before the 9/11 commission report was released, they actually released the Dulles security videos to the news. They didn't put it up on a website yet. It wasn't on the Zacharias Massawi trial exhibit, but all the mainstream news got portions of it, and it's two different angles from the same entry. And 2 of the networks, at least 2 or 3 of them, show an additional Middle Eastern person coming through there, and one of them being CNN say that this extra person is Hani Hanjour, and he's Middle Eastern. He's only got a few things on. He's only got a few very minimal bags. He looks very, you know, pretty much in shape like Al-Madar, like the other hijackers, mm-hmm. And there was no indication of when this person came in through the gate. But the next day on the newspapers, they would, like Los Angeles Time, I've got it all, I showed in the film, they have him on, you know, as one of the hijackers, and they say he's Hani Hanjour. So, and it wasn't, because they figure out who Hani Hanjour is. But here's this 6th Middle Eastern suspect. You know, I don't know. Like, why don't they have the name? Or I don't know. They could be very, these guys could have been very sophisticated as far as their IDs go. You know, and that's obvious that's what happened. I mean, that's why you got cases of living hijackers. That's why it took so long to identify some of these people, you know. Muhammad Atta used a lot of different IDs. So
why 6 on 77? Was there another plane they were supposed to take and they just bailed on it and all went on that? Like, why so many people?
I think because it's DC, you know, and look who was all on board. A lot of military people, you know, you're going to want a big team for that. You know, they definitely want a strike, a DC, a government building, especially the Pentagon. I think the second target would have been CIA headquarters. Then they really wanted to give that message, but they did that. But at the same time, that does not mean that Dulles Airport wasn't going to have other planes hijacked from there, because there seems to be some reports indicating that. And separately from all of this, if anybody wants to see for themselves, I actually did acquire some unreleased security video from Dulles Airport, not just from 9/11, but from the day before. And when I say the day before, it does pertain to this claim I had mentioned earlier about Marwan al-Shehhi being seen at Dulles Airport. And I've got some security videos that seem to be indication of some of the employees reacting to a circumstance like that. But point being is that I've gone through it all, and it's not all the videos. It's a very select few, and it was I got it through National Archives. Kind of was really hard to get, actually. And it seems to be a bundle of videos that was submitted to the DC Airport Bureau. There was some generic name like that, but it's only 13 videos. And on some cases, like I've even got security videos at the other gates, and it seems they, like the videos I've got, they cut it. It's like it's edited. And it's like when certain people are starting to walk right in, like people that I think, you know, these guys could be suspects. You know, they look like they're also from the Pacific Islands, you know, they look like they, you know. So I've actually looked much more in depth as far as that goes, but it's only available on my Patreon. So.
Gotcha. So at Logan, some of these guys had ramp passes, right? So they could actually go out to the tarmac and where the plane's getting ready and everything. Was that just at Boston, or is there?
That's going to be all the airports. They had everything. They had IDs. I mean, yeah. And that's just unrestricted access. I mean, yeah, these people posed as, in some cases, you know, they knew people that were working in the airports, or they, you know, they worked for them directly. Yeah, they had all that stuff. Yeah.
So what level of oversight do you think this is? Like what I know you basically implied that what happened at Boston Logan was insider information, like they knew it was taking place, but what level of knowledge are we talking here, do you think?
No, knowledge from who? As far as the conspirators themselves?
Yeah, like who? I mean, who actually knew?
I would actually assume that all these hijackers, like the main ones that we focus on, they were familiar with multiple airports, like. Mm-hmm. Like they were able to fly into other ones, like pretending to be employees. They knew the ins and outs of many airports, because there are other cases of these guys being seen at other airports, making a, you know, total weird, crazy scenes, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, like James Woods, the actor, seen him, you know, flew with some of them, you know, weeks before and all that. I've heard cases. Yes. So yeah, these guys had access to multiple. That's all they did. They never stayed anywhere. They're always just stay for a few days. They just travel. That's all those guys were doing. Just getting used to everything. Yeah.
So what I'm asking is, was there administrative knowledge within the airport that this was taking place, or do you think that they were just really good at what they were doing?
Administrative knowledge, I don't think so, but I think they knew they obviously had a problem as far as, you know, the people they would just kind of hire, and you know, the, you know, security violations, you know, stuff like that. What was your other question? I'm sorry, what was the other thing you said?
No, that was basically it. I was just wondering if you thought that there was any you know, instead of this just being a bottom up operation aside from funding or whatever, like I was wondering if you thought that people were placed in airport administration to make sure that this could be carried out, or if it was
possible. I think that's possible. Yes, I think that is possible. I think that's possible for even people working for Saudi Airlines. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, there's a good reason for Saudi and possibly other airlines. Yes. Because you have access to those. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I do. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so how many of these do you think, all these planes were that they weren't hijacked midair, or that they were like, it was that the, or let's put it this way, that if a lot of these guys were, like we said, maybe misled as to what they were actually doing, they didn't realize this was a suicide mission, do you think every single plane they actually had control of before they took off, and then they just, the co-pilot didn't know about it or something, and he's the guy that got killed? Because I know there's reports of the pilots being stabbed and everything. So how does that work? They're just in the jump seat, and then they take the pilot away, they take the control away from the pilots, and they still kill them. That all still happens in the air, right? How does that take place?
I'm not sure. Like, you know, we don't like with Flight 77, it's very hard to tell because it seems like with that one, they moved all the pilots to the back of the plane because that's what the indications are, you know. But then again, if they had six people hijacking it, that's enough manpower for people to, you know, obey, you know. As far as like killing, like subduing the pilots, you know, it's like with Flight 11 that, you know, God, if things went down, like I mentioned, like having access to the cockpit already before takeoff, we can only imagine what he used to kill those pilots. I mean, he could have used some other sophisticated weapon, may have not even been bloody at all.
Yeah.
You know, who knows? But in some cases they, you know, we know that they saw, people saw what was going on, you know, for the most part. No, there was something you were talking about with the actual takeover with the plane. Like what else was it? What else did you want to know?
No, that was basically it. Like how violent of a transfer of power for the plane there was, you know, like, because what we're basically led to think is that there was pretty low security because nothing like this had happened before. And then they just pretty much opened the door and then just killed the pilots, right? So there might have been a little bit more intricate of a transition there because they were insiders already. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yes. Yeah, they knew ins and outs and everything. I mean, too much. And we know there was like dry runs. I mean, like, look at that situation in 1999 with those two Saudis that were on a flight from Phoenix to DC. And in mid-flight, they opened up the cockpit door and went into the cockpit while it was flying. While they were flying, they're like, what the fuck are you people doing here? You know, and when they landed, they even took photos of these guys, but I'm sure they were questioned and all that, but they turned up to be, you know, from the Saudi government admitted to it that it was like a dry run test already, you know, basically seeing what they could do. Yeah. I mean, and then that's what we know happens with Boston Logan, because Atta has seen numerous times at Boston Logan, you know, in the months ahead, and they had access to the communication tower. I mean, if you could get all the way up there, I mean, come on, you're gonna have access to the whole thing, you know?
Yeah. So let's shift gears here a little bit. Let's talk about the moving company, and the dancing Israelis and all that. So Ryan's told me there's like, I think he said there's more than two witnesses to the dancing Israelis. Now I only know of the one. Do you know of any more than just the woman who was looking with her binoculars at the towers? Or
there's supposed to be others. Somebody who was painting an empty apartment at the Doric Towers. And I would think there was someone, I think there's someone else, unless that's the one. But then there's also other people, tenants, that recognize some of them there the day before as well, or even previous to that, because apparently Urban Moving Systems had even serviced, you know, did move-ins for other people in that building.
So on the day of,
I at least know there's a painter and it could be another one besides Maria. Yeah.
All right. So kind of the big story you were uncovering in one of these films, the one about the George Washington Bridge, is that's actually an urban myth with Urban Moving Systems. I like that little play on what that was covered. But it actually wasn't stopped on the bridge, and it also wasn't full of explosives, and that was all actually figured out within the same day. But that's a theory that's been kept alive. That's not really true. You want to just expound on that a little bit? What happened there?
Basically, the reports about the van packed with explosives on the George Washington Bridge, they are basically late reports about the police van from the dancing Israelis van still being searched in the Meadowlands. That's why they kept. If you listen to the George Washington Bridge reports, they all say in the Meadowlands. Well, I got bad news for you. The George Washington Bridge is not in the Meadowlands. It's further inward. And this turned into, a repeated report. And once Dan Rather picked it up, all the other ones were repeating it, except for ABC's John Miller. And it's interesting because those guys had the most intel with the police and FBI. When John Miller reported it, he even said they got a van pulled over in the Meadowlands. He did not say the George Washington Bridge. He did not say, you know, he said the explosives, a van packed with explosives, but he said it's in the Meadowlands. So, you know, he's going off good intel. And the reason why this report picks up so late, because if you know the official story on the Dancing Israelis, those guys get caught at 3 o'clock. But when the, you know, when they go through all their, you know, the process of the police, they're apprehending them, the reactions and the bomb sniffing dogs at 5:30, they basically close off the surrounding area, which where they were pulled off at was just a few hundred feet away from a river bridge. So this is why we think this is raw information. Basically, maybe the police, when they were apprehending them, they're like, you know, hey, we're getting close to them. They're getting near the bridge, you know. And also at the same time, the police bolo said, hey, look for this van. They could be targeting the George Washington Bridge. Because then they always knew that was always going to be a potential target. Because if you know anything about the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, it's not that hard to figure out.
Right.
So at 5:30, they're closing off the bridge, obviously, but they clear out the surrounding area, which includes the hotel that was near, and that was also near I forget which football stadium. It's torn down now. They got a new one now there. But that's at 5:30. And the photos that we all see from ABC of the Dancing Israelis van in the distance parked over to the side and some of the police on top of the squad car that's in the distance, that's a photo taken from somebody staying at that hotel, because they told everybody in the hotel to clear out of the area. So you got to wonder, like, why would you stay at a hotel, you know, on 9/11 and take a photo of some pullover scene? But that's why you would, if you're being told this guy might have a bomb, you know, explosive, whatever, and get the fuck out of here. So, you know, somebody took that photo. Those are those photos you see of the white van in the distance. Here's the thing. They had the perimeter closed off all the way until 10 o'clock at night. So by 10 p.m., you know, that's when those news reports start to come out about a van packed with explosives, because they've got the streets closed off. They're still doing an investigation. Marsha Kramer's basically the CBS newscaster that started this whole theory. She's basing it off like rough information, like, hey, they arrested these guys, and it's like, you know, it's a big score, it's a big fine, because, you know, well, yeah, you're sticking to the bolo. We know why they're being searched for, because they were acting really suspicious at the Doric Towers and whatnot. So they probably, Marsha Kramer probably picked up part of the bolo, maybe. But the thing is what CBS News, CBS 2, Marsha Kramer, their normal police sources were always Port Authority. And they weren't getting this information from Port Authority. They were getting this information directly, it was coming secondhand from the police. The reason why they weren't getting any information from Port Authority, like normally, is because Port Authority offices were in the World Trade Center. They were destroyed. So she wasn't getting the best police intel either. So that's why, like, when I point out in my film, the explosives on the George Washington Bridge, you see Mary Garofalo, the Fox News reporter, who's the second reporter reports about the GWB incident, besides Dan Rather following on Marsha Kramer. And, you know, she's very specific. She says at 5:30, you know, they pulled over at 5:30. That's when the vans are, you know, that's when the surrounding area is being closed off. And right. She says it's only three guys, you know, and she's very, and then, but here's the most important part is all these reports were then later retracted. They said it was a van, but then an hour later, they all start saying, oh, it's not on the GWB, but there are arrests.
Yeah.
Which so is what, why we had the Dancing Israeli story. This is why everybody was reporting this all the way into the late evening of 9/11, a van packed with explosives. So, you know, that's, you know, when that story got buried, somebody had to, you know, somebody wanted to find out why did they mess up so bad. And this is why we got the story in the next day in the Jersey Record.
Yeah, so it's almost the classic bait and switch that you're always, you know, you talk about with the no planes at the Pentagon. If you have no plane at the Pentagon, you don't have the hijackers financed by the Saudis. So if you have a truck full of explosives that they're going to blow up, why would you have the guys taking pictures? You know, I mean, what happens to the pictures that you take of the planes hitting the World Trade Center if you just go blow yourself up, you know? And like, I don't know, it doesn't, if they're rejoicing or whatever, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's too risky. The problem is that it's mixed in with the GWB. It's mixed in with the story with the van on King Street, you know, with the mural and all that, which is legit. There are reports of another van, people calling in saying there was another van by the Newark airport, some Arabs mixing some junk or whatever. That could have been BS, you know, but that they were doing something all the way that late in the evening, that there was follow-up attacks that late. No. And like I point out all the way out throughout the film, nobody would have been able to make the bridge. They had the bridges closed off like before noon, like right after the attacks. All you could do was exit. That's it. All you could do was exit out of Manhattan by that point.
Yeah. So in the towers, what level of explosives do you think were there? Do you think they were just bombs in the basement, or do you think they had them on the columns on the way up, or what do you think?
I think there were explosives on the bottom. I think some were meant to go and kind of like set up as booby traps to freak people out at first. I think there were explosives in the center columns. I just don't think that they were on every floor. I don't think they were on every column either, because you got 47 columns. And I don't believe that the exterior columns were put in explosives. I think that's just all falling in, you know, bending outwards from basically weakening out the center as soon as you get the center weak enough. But I do believe that the collapses start where the plane impacts start. Now, right. whether those collapses are starting, you know, from explosives, you know, I don't know. They may have been starting to collapse, you know, because of where it was damaged. But I believe at some point, you know, this stuff was being all eyeballed. I think there was operatives had, you know, total view of it. All they had to do was pull a switch, you know, and, you know, that's could have been, you know, that may have been done at the same time as when the collapse started. But at the same time, you know, there are reports about the explosives, you know, shaking down below. I've heard it from a personal account, somebody actually being there. The ground shook before the collapse started at the impact center. So that's also the possibility that did too. But I still believe, yeah, like maybe every 10, every 20 floors, there may have been explosives in some certain center spots. But like I said, I don't believe it's all columns. I don't believe I don't even like calling it a controlled demolition. It's a demolition, but yeah, it's not controlled.
Yeah.
It's not controlled in the industrial intent, industrial style, you know, it's not, you know.
Yeah. So, I mean, wasn't some of that explosion happening in the basement from the jet fuel going down the elevator shafts when the planes?
They say that, but that's impossible. I mean, that's not going to blow out marble from the panels inside. And, you know, they said that only happened through the freight elevator, but that's not what it's going to, there's no, I mean, you would have seen things singed and things. Yes, there were parts, some of it dripped and there were some people caught on fire because of it may have dripped from the top, from above, but you know, a raging fireball all the way a quarter mile, you know, up basically. I'm just like, no, you're not going to have all that power going straight downward. I mean, all that is going straight horizontal. It's, you know, it's going. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not a physicist, so I just don't know anything about that, but I don't really know. We're coming up on about an hour here, but why don't we end with just kind of your overall hypothesis on what level of involvement you think the Pakistani ISI, the Israeli Mossad, Saudi Arabia, and United States intelligence agencies had with this? Do you think this was planned for years and coordinated between them, or do you think it was a mix of something that they saw coming that they could exploit, or what are your overall thoughts on that in general?
With the U.S. involvement, I tend to think that if they knew, they may have known about it. They may have been let it go. But I don't think there's direct involvement as far as planning with, you know, them on an international, you know, mix like that. I think there's a lot of neglect, you know, there's a lot of neglect with information, but, you know, at the same time, I also consider the fact that I am talking about a bigger cover up, a bigger conspiracy, more people that were going to be involved in more hijackings. But my God, I mean, how sloppy were they? If we're only talking about Khalid Al-Mardar and Nawaf Al-Hazmi, mm-hmm. you know, if there's going to be, you know, more than a dozen planes or whatnot, you know, to me, it's just this 9/11 is like, what it proved is that the 1993 World Trade Center bombing was not solved. So there eliminates the idea that if this is just a, you know, the ultimate plan. I think there was a target. There was a motive, and one of the motives was to just, you know, to finally destroy the Twin Towers. Mm-hmm. I think that was an objective. How long that objective have been out there? I think it's been out there for a long time, and I think it's been out, yes, through the Middle East, you know. Now, but coming up to 2001, as far as the other states involved, Saudi Arabia, what's their involvement? Seems to me, yeah, they may have been sponsoring some of these hijackers. They may have been also deeply involved in controlling the apparatus with all the the nonprofit charity groups, all the mosques, and all the Islamic, you know, organizations. I think that's one way, but that's not, you know, you don't need, but at the same time, this conspiracy is big. It's not just going to necessarily rely on fundamentalists. You know, there's very much could be very much Arab secular, you know, that want to strike at the U.S. and
right.
Also have a profit motive too. Saudi, Pakistan, seem to be involved more than what we're being told. And I think they're more involved than they actually Saudi Arabia. There's just too much protection that's gone on there. And it already goes, you can already see it going back already in 1993 with the World Trade Center bombing. That's one of my best films. I do recommend to watch my 1993 World Trade Center bombing on my channel, because that's the most more blunt, mind blowing. And it kind of really shows more of how Israel infiltrates these groups. And I'll get into that point too, but, Pakistan, you know, with 1993, you know, it's just that, you know, we know that there's always that relationship going back with the ISI and the Mujahideen, you know, Osama bin Laden. It seemed they protected Osama bin Laden, obviously, you know. So, yeah, and I think that's kind of a big insult. And I think, you know, I think there should be a lot more pressure put on that as far as victims' families, you know, from 9/11 suing, or, you know, we shouldn't be funding people like that, you know, doing business with people like that, with countries like that. But Israel, how is Israel involved? Well, they're involved by their Mossad agents that obviously are always next to these hijacking cells and could be doing a lot more than just monitoring them. They don't seem to warn us when these things, you know, are about to happen, but they seem to be involved in more greater depths than that, because they do infiltrate these Al Qaeda cells. They do have their assets. There are multiple overlapping interests, you know, because lots of times, you know, we're funding, you know, Israel's funding these people as proxies because they don't like the leader of their country, and they would rather, you know, they'd want them removed, and they will, you know, get involved with a false flag or a terrorist act to set that pretext. So there's multiple ways that they're able to find, you know, the different Arab proxies, fundamentalists, commandos, where or whatnot. But then they are also able to infiltrate directly, you know, posing and masquerading as a Muslim, because of the fact that Israel's population also has Arab Jews, which are dark skinned. There are the original Jews that have been there. And there are cases, they're called Mistar Arvim, that the Shin Bet or even the Mossad or whatever, because apparently Mossad's very, very secretive and has other different factions too, obviously. They're able to masquerade as a fundamentalist for years and years, for decades, and even have families, and they'll be living in Middle Eastern countries, posing as an Arab Muslim, and basically working for Israel, or moving things. I think there's a bigger apparatus, an older apparatus that Israel has power with. And I don't want to get into all that because it gets really obscure, but I think this has a lot to do with Palestinian splinter groups too, which were the secular communist groups. And because there are cases, historical cases, where they seem to have been directly working. And I'm talking about the ones that are like tied in with Operation Gladio. So that is how Israel would have been involved multiple ways they have to get involved.
Well, you certainly supply a lot of interesting information. I was trying to absorb everything in your video, but I actually put a tweet out today. Like, you, Scott Horton, Ryan, Adam, like, you guys just have, I don't know, you got brains that can just retain shit. I have to really pay attention and watch things a couple times, but I'd highly recommend people check out your channel. I've got it linked in the description, Truther TV. And then I've got your Twitter linked in the description so people can follow you there. But where else can people keep up with you? Have you got any projects coming up you want people to know about? Anything else you want to say?
Patreon. If you want to see exclusive stuff that I haven't released, Patreon, because I've got a lot of information that I've just not making public yet, because it's kind of ideas that I want to put into a book, because I do want to write a book. And, just basically Twitter, Facebook, my YouTube channel. I have my blog, but I don't write very much. But you can find it. It's 9/11 Skeptics Versus Truth. It's a WordPress blog. But that's pretty much it. I don't have a website. I just, I'm not a blogger. All I focus on is basically 9/11 and those things related. I even focus a lot with the OKC bombing as well, too. So. And, and definitely the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. That's one of the ones I put a lot of work in too. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'll certainly have you back on again. You guys have, I wouldn't say reignited because it never existed before, but you've ignited an interest in me in this stuff, because I used to not pay attention to it at all. Because, some of this stuff, if you start talking about it, people just write you off as a kook or whatever. But you, Adam, and Ryan, I'm really impressed with the, I don't know how much of it, kind of like you guys, I don't know how much of it is going to end up being true or whatever, but it's very interesting. And I think you guys are approaching it from a position of humility and trying to figure out what actually happened, not just kind of being fantastic and exciting and, as flashy as possible, like other people who talk about this stuff. So, yeah, guys, go check him out. Go subscribe to him. Follow him on Twitter. I don't know when I'm going to be live streaming next. I think I have Buck Johnson coming on this week. It's either this week or next week. I forget. But I am doing a couple interviews. I think Top Lobster's coming on at the end of the week. So stay tuned. If you haven't subscribed to the channel yet, please do so. Follow me on Odyssey. And I've got all the links in the description. You can follow me. And thank you, Nelson, for joining us again.
Thank you, Reed, and I appreciate it. And hey, I'm the same way, man. I gotta watch these things a lot too myself to rip the sink in. I'm the same, so it's no, don't feel bad.
All right. Cool.